This is the Everything Financial Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to listen in again. I'm very excited to have joining me on today's program, Dr. A. Gary Schilling. Dr. Schilling is a Forbes columnist and a terrific forecaster. He is president of A. Gary Schilling and Company. He'll be joining me just momentarily. If you'd like to get some additional free resources to help you navigate what we believe will be a very difficult environment moving ahead for investors, I would invite you to get my free newsletter titled Portfolio Watch. You can get a free subscription delivered to you via email every Monday afternoon by visiting the website YourRetirementOutlook.com and signing up for it. The website, again, is YourRetirementOutlook.com. That's Y-O-U-R, YourRetirementOutlook.com. And if you've not yet requested your free Investor's Discovery Kit, you can get that sent to you also absolutely free. It includes a copy of my book, New Retirement Rules. To get that free Investor's Discovery Kit, just visit investingapproach.com. The website, again, is investingapproach.com. I am pleased to have as a returning guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Dr. A. Gary Schilling. Gary is president of A. Gary Schilling & Company. He is a longtime Forbes columnist. He has been ranked multiple times as Wall Street's top economist. He is a terrific forecaster, and it's a pleasure to have him back on the program. Gary, welcome.
Oh, glad to be back with you.
Gary, let's first of all talk about what's going on in the U.S. economy. Give us your assessment as to the health of the U.S. economy.
U.S. economy is sort of moseying along. It's about a half-speed expansion. The economy is growing about 2% annual rate in terms of inflation-adjusted GDP, and that's about half of what you'd expect after the deepest recession since the 1930s. I sort of sum it up. Actually, it's the title of a book I wrote in 2010 called The Age of Deleveraging, Investment Strategies for a Decade of Slow Growth and Deflation. I think we're getting this working off of all the excess debt that was run up in the 80s and 90s, U.S. consumers, the financial sector here and abroad, a lot of areas. And while adding that debt gave increased purchasing power earlier on and a lot of economic growth, now we're seeing the flip side of that. And it normally takes about 10 years. We're 8 years into it, but at the rate we're going, it may take more than a decade. But I think that's what's going on in the U.S. economy. And that's despite all the monetary and fiscal stimulus that we've had. First the big spending in 2009, big deficits resulting, and, of course, then the quantitative easing by the Fed. But despite all that, this deleveraging is such a powerful force that the net result is slow growth.
Gary, when you reference your book, and I would urge the listeners to pick it up, I have read the book, and it's a terrific read. Gary, you see what's happened to the price of oil of late. Is that a symptom of this deleveraging?
Well, it is, because what deleveraging does is results in slow growth, and when slow growth means excess supply, and in this case oil, but it's true of almost all commodities, the result obviously is lower prices. Oil has got some other features there in that OPEC is a cartel, and cartels are designed to keep prices above equilibrium. Now, that encourages cheating. Some members of the cartel are outside producers. They want more than their share. So the cartel leader's job is to cut its own production to accommodate the cheaters. Otherwise, prices would fall. Well, the Saudis, leader of OPEC, they've gotten tired of doing that. They cut their production, and somebody else moves in. Russia, American frackers, other OPEC members. And so they basically said in their OPEC meeting at the end of November last year, the 27th, when we were sitting down to our Thanksgiving turkeys, they said, we're not going to cut production, and we're going to play chicken. We're going to see who is going to run out of money first and going to have to cut production. Now, in this price war, what ultimately matters there is the marginal cost. It isn't the cost developing a new oil well or meeting a budget. It's what does it cost once the hole's in the ground, the pipes are laid, to get the stuff out. And those prices are in the $20 to $30 a barrel area in Permian Basin in Texas and in the Persian Gulf. So early this year, I went on record saying I thought we would see prices in that range. And, of course, they dropped precipitously. They've rallied a bit in the last couple of days, but I think they're still headed for a lot lower numbers.
How low do you think oil goes, Gary?
Well, I think you will get down to that $10 to $20 a barrel range. Now, it won't stay there forever because at that point, some major producer is going to throw in the towel and cut production, and so you reduce the supply. But so far, OPEC is actually producing more. Back last year, their quota was $30 million a barrel. They basically took off the quotas. They're now at 31.5 million barrels. The American frackers, yeah, they're not drilling as with many rigs, but they're using these horizontal rigs. They're getting more wells per rig, and they've increased their production. And you have production increases elsewhere. In Russia, Iran, you know, Iran is probably good for 500,000 barrels a day immediately from oil they've got stored in tankers around the world if they get out from under their sanctions. I mean, there's really a surplus of oil right now, so I think there's still a lot of downward pressure on prices.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're chatting today with Dr. A. Gary Schilling. Gary is president of A. Gary Schilling & Company. He is a longtime Forbes columnist. And Gary, if someone wants to learn more about your work and your excellent newsletter, what would you have them do?
Well, they can go to our website. It's www.agaryschilling.com. Or they could, if they're interested in a sample copy of our newsletter, we do have a toll-free number. It's 888-346-7444.
All right, and I'd encourage the listeners to check that out. Gary, let me go back and just get your take on where you think other commodities are going. Given that you believe there's probably some more downside for oil, would you think the same of other commodities as well?
Yes, I do. I mean, what happened was Russia joined the World Trade Center at the end of 2001, and commodity prices took off by not by a coincidence in early 2002. Everybody thought China was going to absorb all the commodities in the world, and indeed, for years they were buying over 40% of all the tin, lead, zinc, copper, huge quantities of coal, storing petroleum, and so on. Well, what happened in response to that, a lot of commodity producers got involved in huge projects in the middle of the last decade, and some of these big mines, new mines of copper, coal, whatever, in Australia and Brazil, they take 5 to 10 years to come to fruition. Well, of course, just about the time that they came on stream, global demand was weak, and so you had this huge excess supply, and so we've had a lot of downward pressure on almost every commodity you can name, even agricultural commodities. You get decent weather. After bad weather, farmers plant fence row because prices rise. Then you get good weather. Commodities are cyclical, and they always have been, and they always will be. But the interesting thing is long run, and we've got data going back to 1790, if you can believe it, but long run, commodities adjusted for inflation continue to decline. There's only so much copper in the Earth's core surface, but human ingenuity beats shortages any day. I can remember when grown men, serious economists, said that the telecommunications industry was going to come to a grinding halt because there wasn't enough copper to make all the wires. Well, then fiber optics came along. it's the same story repeatedly for centuries.
You know, Gary, you in your comments mentioned China, and China has certainly started to see their real estate markets correct. Certainly their stock markets have corrected. What's going on in China?
Well, China, I think it's a matter of, Dennis, I think it's a matter of changing perceptions, not reality. China is not an independent growing country. It's not a prime mover. China imports raw materials and equipment and uses them to produce manufactured goods, which they export to North America and Europe. That's a little oversimplified, but that's the guts of the issue. Now, if you have slow growth in North America and Europe, you don't have big demand for anything, including imports, which, of course, are Chinese exports. Now, that slowing has been going on for some time. I mean, China was growing double digits, if you believe the numbers, before the Great Recession. Then they put a lot of stimulus in the economy after the recession, got it back to double digits. It's slowing. They say they're at 7% growth. I'm among those who think that their numbers are only about half of that. You look at electricity consumption or railroad traffic or steel production, auto sales. You look at things that are hard numbers, and they don't tell you they're growing 7%. But in any event, China's growth is slowing. But the thing is that this has been going on, and commodity price declines have been going on since very intently since the beginning of 2011. But most people somehow thought that China was an independent growing operation. Well, it isn't. It's an interpro. It's stuff comes in, it's processed, it's shipped out. And I think what's happened with the big nosedive in stock prices and then the devaluation, that people now realize that China really just doesn't have the growth. The emperor has no clothes. One of the interesting things about their devaluation, they've been holding their currency basically stable against the dollar because they wanted to prove to the International Monetary Fund that they were big boys, because they want to join as a reserve currency the elite group, which is the yen, the dollar, the euro, and British sterling. And the IMF makes that decision at the end of the year. They only do it every once, review it every once every 5 years. Well, China got to the point where they said, hey, everybody else is devaluing, which means their currency was rising against their competitors in Korea and Taiwan and what have you. So they finally threw in the towel and they said, we just got to reduce the value of our currency to make our exports cheaper and imports more expensive to try to stimulate the economy. So I think that devaluation was very much an act of desperation to try to revive economic growth.
I have the pleasure of chatting once again today with one of our favorite guests here, Dr. A. Gary Schilling. Gary is president of A. Gary Schilling & Company. He's been a longtime Forbes columnist. He's been ranked as Wall Street's top economist multiple times, and he's a terrific forecaster. And Gary, in a prior segment, we were talking about China devaluing its currency. And, you know, that seems to be a theme. You know, the United States effectively, through quantitative easing, devalued its currency. Europe is engaging in its own QE program. It seems worldwide we have currency devaluation going on in an effort to jumpstart the economies through exports. How long can this continue?
And everybody's devaluing against the U.S. dollar, and of course we can't devalue. We're the reserve currency. Who do we devalue against? I mean, you know, there's nobody left. So you see the commodity currency, the Canadian, New Zealand, and Australian dollars. Those economies are dominated by commodity exports. They are weaker, and the heads of their central banks are saying we want even weaker currencies. Then you've got the euro and the yen. And they are deliberately being trashed. Again, they want cheaper currencies to encourage exports, to encourage exports, to retard imports. In other words, when you have slow domestic growth, you want to load it on somebody else through foreign trade. And then you've got all the Me Toos. This is the Korea, Taiwan, and now China. We say, hey, we're not going to be left in the dust in this competitive devaluation game. So you got everybody basically devaluing against the dollar.
So when does it end, Gary? How does it end?
Badly, I'm afraid. Well, the thing about it is, to the extent that everybody devalues the same extent against themselves, not against the U.S. dollar, it evens out. But it does disrupt trade when there's the uncertainty as to who's going to retaliate, who's going to devalue next. Of course, this was very much the theme in the 1930s with very detrimental effects. But that's what we're seeing. So it does slow things down. How far does it go? I don't know. Probably a lot further than we are now, because you just don't have the economic growth around the world to provide this domestic stimulus. People are looking to do it through trade.
So, Gary, let me get your take on some asset classes. We've got a number of investors that listen to the Everything Financial Radio program. I read, I believe it was a tweet, or maybe it was on your blog, that you thought that the volatility in today's stock market resembled the volatility we saw prior to the flash crash in 1987. So given that statement, where do you think stocks are headed?
Well, it's very interesting. Matter of fact, I've got in front of me some charts that we're going to have in our September newsletter insight, and it's showing that in the last, if you look in the last seven trading days, the S&P average change, and this is regardless of signs, in other words, an increase is in effect counted the same as a decrease, the average change is 2.4%. And if you look at it, what it was before the 87 crash, it was 2.1%. Now, just to show how out of step those were, if you go back the previous month, rather than 2.4 we've had in the last 7 days, it was 0.5%. In other words, you're up almost five times as much volatility. And again, if you go back to before the 87 crash, it was 0.8% versus 2.1. It was almost three times as more volatile at the end there. And I remember that well. You'd have these stocks that go up, go up a couple, 2 or 3% one day, and then down 2 or 3%. And that's what concerns me. So I don't know whether we're in for a big sell-off in stocks, but I would say the stocks are not cheap now. If you look at them in relation to earnings, and particularly if you take into effect the earnings have not been solidly based on top-line revenue growth. Slow economic growth, so unit volume growth for corporations is low, and of course no inflation, so there's no pricing power. They can't raise prices, so they've relied on cost-cutting, and most cost-cutting is labor. But they've sort of run out of those opportunities, at least for now. So the profits growth has not been solid. Stocks in relation to earnings or anything else are not cheap. And when you see this kind of action, you say, wait a minute, what's going on here? I mean, is this a kind of environment? But I'll tell you where we are, Dennis, and we do manage money. But right now we are short commodities, things like oil, copper, sugar, and so on. We are long treasury bonds because that's the safe haven, and particularly in a period that looks more and more deflationary, they benefit, and foreigners want to be here. And we're long the dollar, which again is the safe haven, and everybody's devaluing against it. So those are the three principal areas where our portfolios are centered.
So, Gary, when you say you're long Treasury bonds, some of our listeners are probably thinking, wait a minute, interest rates are already near record lows. Are you betting on lower interest rates from here?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And I've been a fan of the 30-year Treasury bond. And by the way, anything, the 10-year note is not a bond, it's a note. But, you know, that's just a matter of the media not getting the nomenclature correct. But the 30-year bond, I've been a fan of that since 1981. The yield on it was 18.21% in October of 1981, and it's now down to 2.8%. And of course, the reason that I've owned bonds over this 34 year period, is not for yield. I couldn't care less what the yield is as long as it's going down. In other words, I own bonds for the same reason most people own stocks, for appreciation. Yeah, the yield is nice as a kind of an add-on. But actually, since the early 1980s, bonds, long-term treasuries in a zero coupon form, has outperformed the S&P by six times. And, of course, they're only suitable for little old ladies and orphans. but that's been our biggest winner for over three decades, and I think we're going to go to 2% yield. And if we do, from where we are now, you could make 25-30% on that long treasury bond from here.
So, Gary, in order for yields on the 30-year to go to 2%, aren't we going to have to see a pretty significant decline in stocks?
Probably. Yeah, probably, because it would suggest that people are really concerned about deflation and that there's enough of a worldwide scare that there's a rush into treasuries from abroad as well as domestically. Yeah, I think that's a very astute observation. It probably is not a very hospitable environment for stocks, and we do own some stocks, but they're defensive. We want things that pay decent dividends and people are going to buy regardless, things like consumer staples and utilities, as opposed to, you know, things that are the higher flyers, because they say I think we're in an environment now where it just is, you know, the Fed is out of the quantitative easing business. That's what pushed stocks really since March of 2009. Stocks more than doubled over that period. It was wonderful. Now they're doing that in Europe and Japan, of course, quantitative easing. But the Fed is out of that business, at least for now. And so I don't think you have that underlying support. And we've been in what I call the grand disconnect. You've had stocks soaring, floating on that sea of Federal Reserve money while the basic economy is just moseying along at a half-speed rate of growth.
So, Gary, that was actually going to be my last question to you. You're long the U.S. dollar. Are you at all concerned that the Fed will re-engage in quantitative easing?
I think they might down the road. Now, of course, immediately the question is, are they going to raise rates? And you know, they have perennially over-forecast growth. 2012, 13, 14, and 15, each year they started 4% real GDP growth, then they crank it down to reality, 2%. And every year they say we're going to raise rates, you know, 6 months later. I think they've maybe painted themselves into a corner now where if they approached it without all this history, they'd probably say, hey, we better stand aside. There's enough turmoil in the world. But they've got a credibility issue, and maybe they will raise rates here. But if they do, I think we very well, or even without it, we very well could see a return to doing something. Quantitative easing doesn't do that much good. It pushes up stocks. But since stocks are owned by predominantly by high-income people who do not adjust their spending for goods and services that much in relation to their assets, you know, they got three cars in the driveway and haven't got room for a fourth one, it doesn't do much for the economy. But it's about all the Fed can do. You know, all they can do is raise and lower interest rates, buy or sell securities. That's it. They can't affect unemployment directly. It isn't like fiscal policy where they can go out and increase unemployment insurance benefits if they want to pinpoint that. It's, monetary policy is a very blunt instrument, but it has not been very effective in pushing the economy. Push stocks, but not the economy.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Dr. A. Gary Schilling, president of A. Gary Schilling & Company. And, Gary, we thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Dennis, and look forward to doing it again before too long.
And we look forward to having you back as well. Also, if you'd like to get my weekly market analysis, I have a free newsletter that I'd love to share with you. All you have to do to get a free subscription is visit yourretirementoutlook.com. That's Y-O-U-R, yourretirementoutlook.com, and sign up for it, and we'll be glad to share it with you.